Well, good morning from San Francisco on a beautiful day. We're sitting in our Tech Target offices, and I'm staring across from Mr. Simon Crosby. So how are you today, Simon?
Great. Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
And Gabe, are you doing all right? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine, so I'm doing well, too.
Cool. Well, and thank you all who are listening, and keep on sending those ideas coming in. We've got a bunch of things to talk about today. But first, I mean, probably a lot of people know Simon. I know Simon. but Simon was the CTO or one of the CTOs of Citrix.
Right. Data center and cloud.
Okay.
So I came in as CTO from Zensource, and then I ended up being CTO for data center and cloud.
How did you, and I don't know if we ever talked about this, I mean, how did you get started sort of in IT and get hooked up with Zensource and all those folks?
Oh, so I was long way back in the past. I was faculty at Cambridge University, and I was delighted to leave when I saw the incredible brilliance of people coming up beneath me who were way smarter than me, like Ian Pratt, who's the chair of Zen.org, and Steve Hand, and the key founders of Zensource. So all the tech basically for Zensource came out of Cambridge. In the meantime, I had done another startup, 1998-ish time. So I went. That was my exit from university land. And then I went to Intel, where I tried to stop Intel from doing AMT. failed. one of those fabulous technologies which has limited value. But then I went on to do Zensource with Ian and the crew from Cambridge. And Zensource was pretty much the Cambridge systems group going out and doing hypervisors. So that's kind of where it all started for me.
And then the press release or the announcements around you leaving Citrix, I kind of feel like they wanted to make it seem like, hey, we're still friends. It's okay. I mean, are you involved with Citrix now, or did you actually?
No, leave? I have neither Ian nor I has any relationship with Citrix now.
Okay. And you now, I know, are associated with a company called Bromium. I don't know if that's your, is that your company or your?
Yes. So Ian and I, another brilliant guy, but there are two brilliant people, Ian and this other chap, Gaurav Banga, who was the CTO and SVP of engineering at Phoenix Technologies. Now, remember Phoenix did a thing called Hyperspace?
Hyperspace, yeah.
And this was the Hyperspace guy, right?
He is the Hyperspace guy.
It went to HP, right?
It did, and it was behind the HP claim to do WebOS on every PC.
And look where that got him.
Can he buy that back now for about 2 cents on the dollar?
Yeah. It's a Zen-based embedded client hypervisor. I don't think we need to buy it back.
Oh, wow. So how did you hook up with him?
Actually, I knew him from when they were planning to do that. So 4 years or so ago, while we were doing Zensource, which was all server-side vert, he came along and asked us how he should go about doing a client-based hypervisor. By the way, doing a client-based hypervisor is a big deal. Client-based type 1 is really hard for all the device reasons. And anyway, so I've known him for about 4 years doing that. Then after those assets got sold to HP, he went off and started thinking hard about some other interesting problems, which is what Bromium is tackling now. And he and Ian and I got together towards the end of last year and kind of hatched a plan. Told Citrix about it right back then. And then it took about 6 months to kind of finish doing what we were doing for Citrix and get out.
And so this was not something you wanted to do for Citrix. This is, I mean, I guess you've been involved with a couple startup companies, and I'm assuming that's kind of where you get the most fun out of working.
That's not necessarily true. I really enjoyed Citrix. Citrix was fabulous for me because I got such a broad purview of everything that's going on in the industry and got to meet that many, so many customers and channel and, no, even you, right? That is, it was fun. But
that was, it's fun, yeah.
It's fun. But actually, at the end of the day, in any large company, when you have a set of technologies going down a path, every little bit of your capacity is thrown at just the natural evolution of your technologies, right? So you can't do anything big and scary. And Citrix has got a big portfolio.
Like motel art almost.
Yeah, right. And a little bit. And Citrix got a very, very big technology portfolio, arguably bigger than their revenue can, so it's really, it's tight, right? And so that's good. But it means that if you want to do something which is big and scary, then you can't do it.
That's not the place to be.
Not the place to be.
So talk about Bromium. I mean, we don't, Bromium hasn't much been really said about that, like publicly, right?
That's right, because we only just popped out and started it. So it does, you know, we haven't even announced a product or anything else. But you know, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, or maybe it's an acorn. so we're doing virtualization stuff. It's hypervisor based, but it's a new kind of hypervisor. And we think we've solved some really pretty fundamental problems that arise in, let's just call it the intersection of virtualization and security. That is, if you step way back and say, what is the value of all this virtualization technology anyway over some period of time? It's easier to take the following view, that a server-side hypervisor ultimately is going to be valuable for legacy workloads on legacy, you know, new hardware for legacy workloads in the enterprise private cloud or private data center. In other words, it's server vert stuff.
Yeah.
But is a hypervisor really valuable in the big public cloud? Yeah, kind of not.
That you don't care because it's not all these new right. applications are not written for these old monolithic servers that have their own everything.
I mean, if you're writing an app for your iPhone, right, you don't care about the fact that Heroku happens to be, or whatever it happens to be, Node.js is running on AWS on a VM eventually, but you don't really care about the hypervisor there, right?
Right.
It happens to be there, and it's useful for something. And so ultimately, and Facebook doesn't care at all about hypervisors. Why? Because they just want to run every server to the max with a single OS, right?
And that's okay. Google the same way. And
right. And so to the extent that you care about a hypervisor on the client, you absolutely don't ever want to see it. And so this is the problem with Fusion and Parallels and all these things is, you know, users don't want VMs, right? They just don't. It's a horrible abstraction. And so ultimately, the value of a hypervisor per se needs to be questioned. I am convinced that when we look back at it 5 years from now, we'll believe that the value of virtualization technology is isolation and security, far more than all of the illities we've got out of server vert. Okay. I mean, you get all the isolation properties, you see what it looks like there. But nobody's really said, okay, great, if I'm knowing what I know now about hardware, you know, how can I really go and solve or have a big whack at the security problem using these technologies?
Because the hypervisor, it evolved out of the fact, the legacy of how hardware was built and how OSs were built. So it's one of those things.
Actually, I think the hypervisor evolved out of a natural tension between Moore's law and a human practice of installing software on machines, right? That is, IT practice was install an OS on the local hard disk. That's all you can ever get to run on one machine. Meanwhile, the machine had so much more capacity, and so there was all this capacity wasted, right? Hypervisor said, great, now you can take advantage of Moore's law. Unfortunately, you had to buy a hypervisor to do it, but basically you got to buy a server and then use Moore's law, right?
Sly. So Bridget is actually in our chat asking about, you know, Bromium's hypervisor that's different than Zen client. Because you mentioned, you know, the user experience for hypervisors, but you mentioned these type two, you know, Fusion and Workstation. If Zen client hides the fact that it exists, is that still a bad user experience?
So in terms of a hypervisor in general, there are you know, the traditional notion of a hypervisor, you have all the guest operating systems and their apps within them. And so the challenge there is that either you're forcing virtualization into the user experience, that is, the user is explicitly tabbing between VMs or virtual worlds. By the way, the same is true as if I present a VDI-style virtual desktop onto my Mac. I've still got to tab between
them.
Right,
two start menus and two wallpapers.
So there's that. Then Zen Client has a way in which you can mash up the GUIs. That is, the UI becomes a mashup of multiple VMs
worth
of apps.
Seamless windows and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, kind of seamless stuff. The challenge is that many of the traditional abstractions of the OS don't work then. So I might want them to work, policy-based or whatever. That is, the user gets confused nonetheless because they do copy and paste and then, you know, doesn't want to or something. And so the problem is that ultimately the user's understanding of what the OS experience should be, that is all the concept of what a desktop is, suddenly breaks because it doesn't work the way it's expected to.
But and copy and paste is a simple example that we can solve with clipboard reflection and stuff like that. But like the things like, oh, your USB accessories are only available in these applications, but not right. These applications, and this graphics card is only this application. So kind of hiding the fact there's two separate OSs running is almost worse for the user experience in some ways, because it makes it even more confusing.
And each one of these
solve a problem, but you'll introduce so many more.
That's exactly right, Gabe. You end up challenging the user, then ends up having to try and figure out what the different device and application abstractions are in each one of these OSs, and try and build a model of what the world really looks like when it, you know, and that confuses them. And so the more where Zen Client ended up, that is the default way that Zen Client gets shipped to users today, is that you explicitly tab between virtual desktops. By the way, that also addresses a client-side security challenge. That is, in general, if you do the GUI mashup, so with seamless Windows and so on, you're vulnerable to an attack in whatever guest does that final render, whereby a malicious driver could reach down into the frame buffer and pull the pixels out, and then you've got a pixel-grabbing attack, which breaks the security opportunity, or breaks the security promise that you made to the user. So the only way to deal with that right now is, in fact, to when you tab between VMs, you have to do an explicit flush of the frame buffer. Actually, what Zen Client does is it maps the frame buffer out of scope between VMs using BTD. There is no actual way to do a copy.
Is that a Zen Client XT feature versus the regular Zen Client? I mean, that would be something that they explicitly do high security environments, right?
It certainly helps. I don't know whether it's an XT-only feature. Mm. I need to go and look. But that was the only way to stop the pixel-grabbing attack was to use VTD. And by the way, the interesting thing is, this is, by the way, Ian Pratt, who's just brilliant. This uses VTD exactly the opposite way than Intel intended it. Right. So what you're doing
Wait. You still need to spend extra money to buy a machine with VTD. So isn't that at the end of the day?
That's true. Yeah. So and Zen Client also uses TXT and the TPM to do a trusted boot. So that's an important component of that XT stack.
So you say the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree. So you describe sort of the challenges of traditional hypervisors, especially around clients. Well, you talked about clients and servers. So you got three smart people. You have the acorn not falling from the tree. You have set up this environment. So where does that take us, the Bromium?
Yeah, so Bromium's technology applies server and client. It applies on traditional PC-style devices as well as on next-gen devices. So it will apply to mobile devices. So really for us, it's about finding the easiest way to get the technology to market. Just to be clear, this is not your mother's old hypervisor, okay? And so mods to the hypervisor are required, which means that you could go and do this for a Zen server or an ESX, right? But you just got to get the code changed, and then you've got to get the customer to flip over their current base, right? So that's hard for a startup. So we're going where there's Greenfield, which is client stuff first, and then we'll work on probably on next-gen mobile devices and so on. And the specific goal there is to cater to this emergent need of essentially me as a consumer being the biggest threat to my enterprise. That is, inherently, the challenge that the enterprise faces with all these client devices is that I have a dual nature. In my role as a consumer, whenever I use the enterprise device, implicitly threaten the enterprise because I have all these zones of trust, which the enterprise certainly does not like, suddenly cohabiting this one blob of code, 60 million lines of Windows, and then threatening the enterprise.
So you've got hypervisor expertise, describe the complexities of the hypervisor. The client hypervisor is a greenfield. You've got users who have single devices that have both enterprise and personal stuff. Where all that comes together is Bromium.
Correct. So, the goal is to give the user just Windows, say, or just Mac, or whatever it is. That is, the user just wants a seamless UX with no changes whatsoever. That is, virtualization is not a value proposition for a user.
Right. Okay. Absolutely.
This applies in VDI too, by the way.
Well, yeah, exactly. And this applies, like, you know, I feel like VDI, you know, I sound like a broken record, was shoved down our throat by people for whom virtualization was a value proposition, which is more like virtualization for server consolidation in the data center.
Yeah.
And then people just thought, well, I want to just get that on all my users. And so,
yeah, hey, we can do that with desktops too, so let's just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I think but what you just said is absolutely spot on, Brian. Virtualization is a value prop to IT. To the application owner, for an application that happens to run in a VM in the data center, the application owner doesn't see a particular value prop there from virtualization. There may be some that come, like
a faster turnaround of provisioning or whatever, but it's not a real kind of thing.
Right.
When you walked in, we were doing our little sound check, and you said something about VDI. you're coming around somewhere. What? Tell me.
Well,
about
we've
that.
Had this interesting debate about VDI. Look, I'm a huge fan of TS, which has, you know, been out there and always delivered enormous cost benefits and all of the benefits of centralization, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm a huge fan of TS. I think it has a long future ahead of it. It also turns out that it's available under a SPLA license, right, where we still have VDA and various other issues. I'm more and more convinced that VDI is just not tenable from a price point perspective and from a complexity perspective. That is, in general, you're forcing the desktop guy or gal to think about hypervisors, to buy servers and storage and deal with network outages and a bunch of other stuff that were previously completely out of their domain.
And by the way, you don't remove all the other complexities of running desktops, like users are crazy and most of our users run with admin rights and they can install whatever they want and
exactly.
They do, you know, everything.
And really, if you're deploying VDI, you know, and the best case scenario is if your desktop brains have all of that knowledge. Otherwise, in a lot of organizations, you see the desktop people fight with the server people because the server guy owns the hardware and the hypervisor and the desktop people own the desktop and they have to work together. And I mean, there's a lot of management complexities, you know, even on the political side too.
Correct. And so I see in several ways. So for example, I think that a lot more virtual desktop licenses have been sold than are in production.
Oh, absolutely. or have been given away. But and that's not a this by the
There's
way like this is
that. We're not well, picking on one group over.
That's what I was going to say. This is not a VMware only thing. Like obviously, you know, Citrix. I mean, Citrix did the trade up, and now a lot of the Zen app customers have become Zen desktop. I'm doing air quotes here. Have become Zen desktop customers, which I feel like Citrix can count them as Zen desktop users, but really they're just using Zen app.
Right. Well, actually, I mean, I think that the path that Citrix will follow naturally will be that Zen Desktop is a brand under which all forms of
Windows desktops.
Desktop virtualization.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
That is, desktop virtualization is bigger than VDI. And so Zen Desktop will become a superordinate brand above Zen App and Zen Client and all these other things you could do. Right.
Yeah.
So that makes sense to me. That is, Citrix broadly wants to be the desktop solution vendor in terms of desktop virtualization, and so they'll go down that path. But I think it's really important that the customers understand what they are trying to get hold of when they go down a desktop virtualization path. And for sure, it is not lower cost.
Oh, well, you know, amen, brother.
Yeah.
So that's been kind of one of my you know, mantras recently, and I talk about now that I don't understand why we got down this whole path of thinking it was ever about lower cost. Because I'd say that anytime you buy something that's new and has fancier features and adds all those more capabilities, it costs more. And people say, well, no, that doesn't apply to IT because you've got Moore's Law and everything. And I say that's bullshit because in IT, take BlackBerries.
Right.
When BlackBerries didn't exist, you know, we bought BlackBerries and BlackBerry Enterprise servers and hardware and training and all that for more money. But IT was okay with that because you spent more money to get more capabilities.
Right.
And I say with VDI, you can get, you know, there's certain scenarios where you can get more capabilities. But why are people wanting these more capabilities but also wanting to save money with that?
Right. So that's the challenge. And if you look at, say, the density you can get. By the way, I think I was very proud to be a Zen App power user at Citrix. That is, my preferred way of getting email was Outlook and until it was until on my Mac, I got Office 2011 for my Mac, at which point everything went away for a bit.
That's when I deleted my instance of Fusion. Exactly. And for me, when Microsoft Windows died, the day that Outlook 2011 came out for Mac.
Exactly. But anyway, that aside, before then, I was definitely a XenApp power user, because running email, I could just leave email running on XenApp, and it was awesome. You've got a server doing it, doing a great job of it, and gosh, I didn't want a desktop. I don't want the pixels called Windows under my, under my app necessarily. I don't care what the pixels are. I just want to get hold of the app, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that at the end of the day, users want apps. Moreover, the trend towards new devices, so tablets and everything else, means that people are rapidly learning that this thing called the desktop, as in a bunch of pixels under my apps, is kind of meaningless. And there are new ways of interacting with apps on a desktop-like environment. So users seem to have grabbed onto that pretty quickly, right? Nobody's worried about iOS being a scary new experience versus Windows. They're all happy. And so the desktop as a metaphor is changing very, very rapidly. And then TS delivering an app to my clients, that's just fine. And if I really cared about the pixels, then we can always do a Windows server, a Windows 7 desktop experience on TS.
Yeah, yeah. And so let me ask you, the only way that I've kind of felt that VDI is going to be successful now, or maybe is successful, and this is kind of getting back to the whole paradox I listed a couple of years ago, where it's only for the use cases where you want your desktop in the data center, but where terminal server doesn't work. And in those cases, it probably is where it's a one-to-one environment where you want to give, it's a one-to-one persistent disk image. So you want to give users, admin rights, and you want them to install whatever they want and just kind of go nuts. And if I need that, but I also need my desktop in the data center, there's where I like VDI. But basically everything else is terminal server. Does that jive with kind of your worldview?
There are some others where you want a highly restricted environment. So, for example, in banking, I've seen, some of the banks have done VDI as the way that their administrators, an administrator of the banking apps will only be able to do so from a VDI hosted desktop, okay? Because that way they don't have vulnerabilities due to real client devices. And so they have this highly locked down VDI only environment where the session is necessarily ephemeral, nothing persists. And the way that the guy gets hold of managing this banking app is to get onto a VDI-based desktop, then from there go and manage the app, and then everything goes away as soon as he's done, right? That's a security reason.
So do you think, if we talk about where the desktops are going, because I wrote probably 2 years ago that I felt like all Windows desktops should just be running in a VM on a client, like why bother putting Windows in the data center? Excuse me. And then I did a session at Brian Forum with Chet and Vanderkesh of Atlantis.
Yeah, right.
And he's talking about, he sees it the opposite, that, as more and more applications become non sort of Windows apps, then we don't need to mess with Windows on our clients. We might as well put Windows on our server, and we might as well use the VDI version of Windows because, it's the same OS as our clients. If we have better, broader application compatibility, and the inefficiencies we have versus a terminal server, those will kind of go away as hardware increases. So I kind of flip-flop. I can see, on the one hand, why bother with Windows in the data center? And that's the view of, like Virtual Computer and, these kinds of companies.
Yeah.
Versus, why bother with Windows on your desktop? If you only need Windows, put it in the data center and forget it.
So, right, that is the big question. So I've been with a couple of big Citrix companies Citrix customers who said, we got this TS thing, it works just fine. What we're going to do is just forget the desktop because it's a pain. We're sure it's going to change in some period of time, and it's a nightmare to do VDI. That is, it's a fundamental shift on our whole IT practice to get to VDI. Let's just agree that the Windows desktop is a pain in the ass. Anything that we have to secure, we're going to deliver using TS, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do related to next-gen devices, right? That's interesting. So I think you have to think about what your real use cases are, or what you're really trying to achieve, right? So what is the value of VDI? It's really worthwhile just going through that. What do you think they are? I mean, I can see that there's the golden image management notion, right?
I don't believe the golden image is true, though. Next. Golden Image, I got Terminal Server for that. Next.
Right. Okay. That is, I can get everything to run. Okay. Then there's the reason you do VDI would be the app compat reason, right?
Yeah. It's for the specific scenario when I want my desktop to be in the data center, and I have application compatibility issues that do not allow that to run on Terminal Server.
Correct. And how many apps is that? What percentage, Gabe?
What of apps that?
What percentage of apps are that hard to get running on Windows Server?
Yeah, Terminal Server. I'm going to say not a lot.
Yeah, I mean not in this day and age. There's a few. Don't get me wrong. Everybody has a story or two, but there's not that many. That's for sure.
Right. Okay. So it's relatively few, and it had to be. You had to be doing that anyway, right? So to my mind, the principal value prop of centralization. There's certainly something in there around security. But I think people are fooling themselves there. That is, I mean, I'll tell you, the obvious one, right? You can have a VDI-based desktop and click on a poisoned email attachment, in which case you're toast. And by the way, then the attacker is in your data center. What do you want to do about that?
That's
one?
That's exactly what I wrote, is that at least what we had in the old days, like in some ways VDI makes you less secure because all these crazy users that are living in crazy user land are now inside the data center in crazy user land. And that's like, yeah. I mean... And we had a lot of sort of free pass with desktop security in the past because we were always able to say, well, it's just the desktop or just the one user, or just whatever. Man, now we're putting them in our data center.
Yeah, and nobody that I've seen is doing something. Well, you could do something about that. You could say all my virtual desktops in my data center on a particular LAN segment, which is different than the rest of that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's the only thing keeping the physical desktops out of there in crazy user land that's out, you know, in cubicle land. You know, it's the network. Otherwise, what's the difference? So you could still put your desktops in the data center. I mean, they could physically be in the data center, but abstracted from the actual servers and the compute stuff via the network.
Yes. So let's just agree. We don't solve the security problem by centralizing the desktop.
Automatically, right. Yeah.
You get some benefits. You get you can make it harder to attack in some certain circumstances. You get to centralize all the data. That is, you know, there's no enterprise data necessarily running around on the client. Okay, great. And then there's this other thing. The other one would be multiple devices. I want to be able to deliver to all my end user devices, including my iPad, right?
Yeah.
And there, I don't think anybody wants a Windows desktop on an iPad. I just think it's a horrible abstraction.
So I agree 100%. Now, why do you think all of Citrix's marketing is iPad, iPad, iPad? Is it? I mean, because
no, because that's a. I mean, so I think TS to an iPad makes a lot of sense. But even though Windows apps generally don't present a great user interface on that category of device because of the, you know, the finger is not a great mouse pointer. You know, in general, the C-level exec is saying, I want all my apps on my iPad. Okay, great. And they can do that. So delivering...
But, I mean, you know, Go to My PC does that too. Or Log Me In. Or
sure.
But, I mean, is that not... like, if all I wanted was my apps on my iPad... It seems like Citrix has done a good job.
It seems like VDI is overkill for that.
VDI is way overkill.
And maybe ZenApp even though too, if you can just if it's a few niche use cases within an organization.
Well, TS in general, for any apps that the enterprise had centralized and wanted to deliver, it's a great way to deliver to an iPad. Any legacy app.
Yeah, I guess if it's already there. Yeah.
But delivering my desktop, that doesn't work. I mean, it's a pain.
Yeah, because what is the and as you say, like what is the desktop and it's just a second navigation system. It wasn't made for my fingers and multi-touch and all of that.
So then there's this very interesting, if you just take the logical progression of those ideas and you look at, say, both what VMware is doing but also Citrix and Receiver, right? So Receiver on the iPad, you get an additional enterprise, you get a new enterprise desktop but on your iPad. That is, I'm in Receiver and here are all the apps I can use. And maybe here's all my state, right?
I should say, to clarify, for those who don't know what the hell you're talking about, Receiver now is not just the ICA client, but it's also like a little app launcher. So you push the Receiver button, and then you see a screen. It's not your remote Windows desktop yet. It's a screen with buttons for all of the specific published apps and desktops and all that kind of stuff. Like, that's what you're talking about.
Right. It's kind of it's your access point to the enterprise app store, kind of, right? And indeed, it has other properties associated with it whereby... You could cache locally on the tablet enterprise state, which would then be encrypted.
What does that mean in English? You can cache enterprise state.
So I could have my files and my folders and whatever else local, right? But they will be encrypted. So, but the problem with that
was it? Yeah.
What? Go ahead, Gabe.
No. There was a name for that, though. What was that last year at Synergy?
Zen Vault, I think they
called
it.
That's what it was. Yeah. Yep, that's right.
There's some eye rolling going on in this room right now when the word Zen Vault was said, and the eye rolling did not come from me or Justin. I just want to put that out there.
But anyway, so the idea there is that you can have – so this is your enterprise point of presence, and it's very similar in philosophy anyway to where VMware is going with Horizon.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I love the name Horizon, by the way.
Why? Because you can.
It's always in the future, far off.
But I mean, it's crazy because right. But then, can I get what is Citrix Cloud Gateway? What's it called now?
No, it's yes, Cloud Gateway.
Can I buy that today?
No.
Soonish. So it's also the future, but we just don't advertise the fact.
That's right. Yeah.
They just don't advertise the fact.
That's right. Right, Project Mirage and Project Horizon. But the logical progression then in terms of the user experience is that on my tablet, I now have this place to go for all my enterprise stuff. And it's very similar to what we started out talking about. Like in Zen Client, I tab between my personal mm-hmm. and my corporate VMs or multiple different VMs. And again, it's invading the UX. It's reasonably well known that Apple isn't in love with that idea because they want to own the UX, right?
And it is a weird experience too. I guess I don't know if you can take the icons out, but it is kind of a mental
flip. You can't.
Because you have my iOS apps that live in the iPad and then my, corporate apps that live inside the iOS app it just feels weird.
Yeah, it's not terribly counterintuitive, but it's basically the same thing. That is that there are two presences on my device. One is my corporate identity and the other one. But that's not how I work. I mean, it's not even how you work. Half the time you're sitting on Twitter, right? You need to be able to do all these.
Twitter's for work purposes only, please. Thank you.
Right. So you're sitting here with you have multiple concurrent threads running through your head.
Yeah.
And it is not the case that you're going to be sitting in one and then really definitely moving to another. But I say very definitely when you currently on iOS, when you leave your Citrix receiver environment, cheerio login and session and all of that state, right? Pop into your other world, use another app for a while, pop back, got to reauthenticate and so on. And they're working on fixing that. But, that's a challenge.
It's a hard context switch.
It's hard.
To switch between.
Right. And that's not how users work. Users bounce around between different apps. And so it's problematic.
So we're talking about kind of where Windows is going and is it on the device? Is it in the data center? I mean, people are talking about also, Windows 8 is going to have a touch interface and that will be the right interface for the tablet. And, everything we're talking about when we say, Windows is not as relevant now to all these tablet and iOS users, they say, well, Windows 8 is going to fix all that. But is that something we've not heard before from Microsoft that the next version of Windows is going to change the game again?
Well, Windows 8.
Microsoft.
Go ahead, Gabe.
Sorry, I always feel like Microsoft undershoots. They aim too low when they go for that kind of thing, and they're going to put out something that's already 6 months behind the times. Apple and Google have spent a long time perfecting this kind of thing. So, and I feel like Microsoft, they either have, I mean, they're going to have to shock the world, I think, to put out something that's relevant.
Well, they are going to have to shock the world, and if they do, then the enterprise will still not be able to adopt it. That is, in general, there's this. I mean, look at HP and their tablet, right? My view on HP and the tablet is if they had just said, this is for enterprise users, we're going to give you a highly stable, more secure tablet environment for enterprise rollouts because Android is a big mess and maybe Apple's too expensive or something.
Yeah.
We're going to stick in this for, God, more than a month. They might have actually sold a few. But then they went and tried to sell them as a consumer device, and the consumer's already been won by the iPad.
Well, and what the hell were they thinking by pricing this thing? It's the same as the iPad. Like, who in the right mind would buy...
Oh, but they can't drop it. So this is so Apple controls enough supply chain that they are the only guys who can compete at that price point.
Oh, yeah. So even at the... Okay, right. So even at that price point, it's probably also...
They're losing money out. It's very, very tough.
Did you see there's a blog post yesterday by some folks in the WebOS group that said that WebOS runs twice as fast on an iPad as it does... Because they were hamstrung. So and this is that they did internally to kind of hack it on to make it work,
Right.
But they were saying that they were so hamstrung, like what the WebOS software team wanted to do, they were so limited by the hardware.
Right.
That's a good point because a lot of people, you know, you, as many people as you talk to, obviously all from the consumers love the iPad, and employees of organizations, when they're acting in consumer mode, love the iPad.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always talk about, you know, is the iPad secure, and how do you secure it, and how do you handle all of that sort of stuff? So, and that was kind of what brought BlackBerry in, and I think people were excited about BlackBerry's tablet, although I had one for all of about 10 minutes before I gave it to Justin. But that's for different reasons. But that I guess was a missed opportunity. So too bad.
Well, the BlackBerry device didn't even have an email client on it, right? And isn't that aimed for organizations and enterprise?
I thought that the BlackBerry device was aimed to go as a companion to your existing BlackBerry, in which case email would have been done by pairing up with your existing BlackBerry.
Exactly. But it was like a thin client to your BlackBerry.
Yeah. But in general, you know, there is a huge enterprise need for tablets, or a huge desire on the part of the consumers in the enterprise for a tablet. But also, there are very definite use cases for tablet form factor devices within the enterprise. Thus far, every enterprise that I've spoken to in the last 6 months or so is rolling out iPads, just because there isn't anything else, and because Apple has done a better job of security than Google.
So, going back to Bromium, you're talking about Bromium, you know, around client devices and all this kind of stuff, and also talking about it at the level of like a hypervisor. Does Apple let you put that on an iPad?
No. I mean, I don't know anybody who can get inside that wool garden. I mean, I just think that they are, and by the way, to their credit, they own that user experience and they're passionate about it and they do a good job, right? So it's very difficult to complain about it. Moreover, they're on, you know, they've been more secure than everybody else thus far. But certainly, in, you know, when you think about the challenges that Google faces with a pretty fractious ecosystem and challenges with security of apps, it's there's a real opportunity there, I think.
Well, and that's a good point, I guess, because a lot of people I know are looking at Android as the, you know, anti-iOS. And certainly I'm an Android phone user, and the reason I chose Android was because it allowed me to do all the things that I couldn't do on my iOS because I thought it was open, but then it's not quite as open as I thought it was. And now we've got, you know, Gingerbread and Honeycomb are out, but I can't get them from my device because my phone vendor doesn't allow it. And so, and then there's ARM-based Android and Intel, or the x86-based Android, which are not compatible with each other. So that
no, they're not. In fact, a lot of the Android, I mean, a lot of ARM apps actually contain ARM assembly, right? So if you look at Angry Birds on the iPhone, or Angry Birds on Android, there is ARM assembly in there.
That's insane. That's hardcore. I didn't imagine that all these guys are running around San Francisco, you know, for all these companies, that they're like, you know, assembly
programmers.
Yeah. So the demo that was done with BlueStacks, which was essentially Android on Windows, right?
Yeah, that's Rosen Sharma.
Rosen Sharma. Yeah. There's a lot of work to get Android to work on x86. A ton of work to get Android to do a decent job on x86.
So they have to, like, is that a whole hypervisor almost? Like they have to take assembly and translate that to x86.
Well,
assembly?
They found, so there are app issues. I mean, so yeah, Angry Birds has ARM assembly in it. They're not emulating that at all. I mean, that stuff has to get redone. But for example, Android has massive limitations in terms of form factor of display devices, screens, and so on, right? And you know, Google's doing a reasonable job there, but it has been a long way behind.
It's hard to write one app that can fit on all screens of all orientations and all sizes, and correct, also maybe has a keyboard, maybe not, maybe it has a pointing device, it's.
And that's Apple's advantage, right? They have one device, two devices, that's it. That's all they have to worry about. And so they can write the hell out of that code, and they can make it a perfect, perfect experience for everybody that has them, because they only have two hardware sets to worry about.
And when you pull that that app's finger, the fart that comes out is just premium, regardless of form factor.
So look, then pop back to hypervisors. You know, VMware has MVP for the ARM. But it's which is really funny, because they always used to tease us about paravirtualization in Zen. It's a paravirtualizing hypervisor because ARM does not have hardware virtualization support. And the whole idea there is that you have two copies of Android, one for you, the consumer, and one for you, the enterprise. I just think that, you know, the enterprise is just heaving a big sigh of relief that in the phone world they don't have to put an OS on it and have their own golden copy of the OS. I don't think that whole model works at all.
Like, it kind of makes the so it takes the advantages you had with mobile and makes it like just as shitty to manage.
That's right.
As your existing.
Certainly, I don't think the enterprise is ever going to want to have their own copy of Android. But by the way, many of these ecosystem challenges are kind of reminiscent of that. That is, does this version of Android support the screen sizes that I have deployed in my workforce?
Right, right.
Huge issues.
But is MVP, and I know Citrix also invested in Trango, I think it was. Or was Trango the one that VMware bought? I can't remember.
Citrix invested in OpenKernel.
OK Labs, right. And VMware bought Trango to be.
Correct.
So both of these, well, first of all, maybe you can tell me, I don't know if this had anything to do with you. I mean, is what Citrix with OpenKernel Labs, is that at all related to what VMware is doing with MVP, or are these two different sort of projects?
So OpenKernel Labs is a completely independent company. They're doing a very good job. So they have about 1 billion devices under running their stuff. They started out on traditional cell phones, then they moved into cheaper smartphones. So virtualization on a phone-style device, initially, the core value prop was fewer CPUs, longer battery life, right? Because in general, you've got code that manages wireline, code that's on the device, apps that are provided by the carrier, and then there's user-installed stuff. And each one of those used to run on its own CPU.
Oh, wow.
Just for isolation reasons. And so that decreased battery power and blah, 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 increases the BOM cost of the device. Virtualization's core value prop was one CPU, longer battery life, and you can keep these different code bases isolated.
So those billion OK Labs in production are actually running multiple side-by-side VMs right now?
Yes.
Like one for, I mean,
one for wireline, carrier wireline facing, and And then so as the newer form factor of devices has come out, OK Labs has seized on this, on a real, what I think is a real opportunity, which is to do the enterprise and consumer distinguish between enterprise and consumer, and they, when they provide their software to an ODM, they provide the ability for there to be a simple swipe and you're in my enterprise land or my consumer land and install apps on either.
Does that exist, or this is just kind of what they're thinking about?
That they demonstrated that 6 or 9 months ago at whatever the last big wireless show. Yeah, so they have that, and that's where their business is going. And again, notice this, right? It's like receiver in the sense that you have this, here's my consumer world and here's my enterprise world, and never the two shall meet. But it's obvious to the user.
So let's kind of jump around a little bit. One of the comments, the questions that came in earlier was, we were talking about HP, and obviously they sort of, you know, got rid of their tablet, the WebOS. They canceled the tablet.
Desktops.
They're thinking about that. Yeah, and they're also the desktop division of that is for sale. The desktop division of HP is for sale. And one of the commenters said, what if they get rid of the desktop division and then does Oracle buy HP?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Who knows whether they would, right? I mean, there's a lot of animosity between the companies. So, Larry might just say, no, I'll just crush you instead. And by the way, the price of HP, the price of HP right now, he might just do that. But, look at that. Just the PC division at HP is what? It's about $34 billion a year in cash flow, of which, say, $2 billion is profit, right? That's a ton of money. My worry there is that, I mean, It's amazing. That would leave Dell as the only nominally US manufacturer of laptops, of PCs, right? Which is a massive change for various federal agencies and a lot of customers.
What happens to who buys this? If HP, because this is the thing, like the HP can only get rid of their PC group if they find someone to buy them.
Right, and think back to when IBM ditched its client, but they announced, when IBM ditched the client business, they said, we've sold it to Lenovo, and they get to use the IBM brand for 2 years, and we'll be continually checking that they do a good job, right?
Yeah.
That's fine. It's just to say, hey, we're out of this, or we're trying to get rid of it. If I was a customer of HP's and I know that they're trying to get rid of it, I'm thinking, damn, what am I going to do next year?
Well, and how, like, is there another Lenovo out there to buy this PC business?
Yeah, I mean, how much would you buy it for? What are we priced at? This just says generating $2 billion of profit each year, right? So, but you've got to put 34 or so of throughput through this thing.
I mean,
so you probably,
like,
buy it for six, right?
Depends on how much debt they throw into it too, right?
Yeah. But it's an acquisition of, several billion dollars, right? Sub 10 probably, but it's a lot of money.
So Bromium is not interested in buying HP's PC business.
Not just yet, thanks.
I wonder if that's something like Zenith, in India, or doesn't Samsung, Siemens, they all make machines, don't they? Maybe they want an entrance in the U.S. market.
Yeah,
a quick way in.
Another interesting one would be, HTC, who've done a great job on the mobile device, in the mobile device form factor, but now facing a barrage of horrible patent things. If they came in and took out the patents from Palm and the PC business, that would make them into quite a formidable competitor.
So just like Google buying the Motorola patents, basically.
Right.
But if if HTC buys both the webOS stuff and the PC business,
yeah,
I like it.
Yeah.
So going through our sort of list of newsy type things that we talked about, you know, the last show, which is 2 weeks ago, since I was traveling last week. RingCube. We talked about RingCube on the show for quite a while last week about Citrix might buy RingCube, and is it about user-installed apps? Is it not about user-installed apps? Obviously,
It happened. End of story.
And then it happened. But still, we aren't quite sure on why Citrix bought RingCube. I mean, there's, you know, some are saying it's about departmental layering. Some are saying really it's about the user customization. I don't know. Simon, what are your thoughts on why Citrix bought RingCube?
So Citrix had a project internally called Project Acorn for ages, right? To essentially solve the layering problem in one way or another. That is, one could say that tactically solving the departmental apps problem is number one, and then you can go down this path of allowing the users to arbitrarily customize their desktop. And so Project Acorn clearly needed more juice than it was getting internally, and so that's my view on why they bought it. So is it useful technology within a portfolio? For sure, it is. So it's an additional set of use cases. But, you know, the interesting thing for me is that, well, as everybody said, okay, great, this is profound stuff, every vendor in that category has sweated bullets, and nobody was chucking off cash, right? That is, in general, I have the same problem. This brings us back to the same problem of VDI. It's more stuff to manage for people whose jobs don't involve those technologies today. So if I'm a desktop guy, here's another bunch of stuff which hopefully works but may go wrong. That leaves users with, actually, as far as I can tell, indeterminate support issues. That is, we don't know because there isn't a decent install base of this stuff yet. And it's yet another bunch of layers that IT has to manage. And IT has never thought of the desktop as a bunch of layers. They just haven't, right? They haven't even got to a point where there is a golden image of the desktop yet.
And I feel so that's because Microsoft has never thought of the desktop as a bunch of layers.
Gosh, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, right.
And ultimately, actually, one way of thinking about all this stuff is, hey, it's Microsoft's problem. It's their problem to fix, right? Go fix it, Microsoft.
Yeah, right. And
hold your breath.
It's also, but and I'm assuming that, I mean, you can probably shed a more enlightened view on it than we can, but like Microsoft, they have no incentive to fix this, right?
In many ways, they do and they don't. Certainly, the security problems, they have a huge incentive to fix, right? They definitely would love to solve the security problems.
Will they sell? Will they sell more Windows if they fix the security problems?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, certainly, so there will be a client hypervisor in Win8. You know that, right?
Is that I know that people are talking about that. That's like something that they're.
It's going to be Hyper-V based. It'll be a Type 1. My understanding of the goals there is it replaces VirtualPC, which is the Type 2 in Windows 7 today.
But they're selling that as a migration strategy, right? They're not really selling it as an actual use, actual thing you use on a daily basis.
Right. And so last time I read up on it, there was this interesting discussion as to whether or not it would be on by default. That is, whether this client hypervisor is on by default. You know, what is the value of a hypervisor in a client OS in general? That's kind of what you're asking. Broadly, it allows you to go down the path of refactoring the code base so that it is more sane. And, you know, if they've taken some of the learning out of MinWin, we have a reduced size core kernel capability, then it's less vulnerable to attacks, and then you can start to divide the system up better. But at the very least, they're going to get a better way of running XP compat stuff, right?
What do you think is going to happen? But XP ends on April 8th, 2014. So, like, does XP...
And by the way, Win8 is not really going to make its way into the enterprise for a long, long time because the enterprise is finally delighted that they can adopt something like Win7, right?
But does XP... I mean, by the time it comes in, so you have XP compat, XP is not supported anymore, right?
Right.
I mean, why bother?
Right.
At least it won't be that fundamental of a change from XP to 7, 7 to 8, hopefully. You know, we don't have to worry about profile migrations and things like that, or at least we haven't heard about that. So maybe it will be adopted more quickly than Windows 7 has been. But yeah, you're right. It'll still be a while before it's adopted
enterprise,
widespread.
I mean, how far is Windows 7 in its adoption curve now? Maybe 50%? I don't know.
50? Yeah, if that. Yeah.
Okay.
Not too far.
So, I mean, by the time Win 8 comes out, which is roughly a year away, yeah, we are only another.
Can you imagine supporting three OSs in your enterprise? So if you have some Win 8 and you've got, you know, 50% Win 7, say, when Win 8 comes out, and then you still got some XP out there. Wow. Yeah. I feel bad for that, for those guys.
Yeah, it's tough. So, and I think Win 8 is being very, very, very heavily focused on consumer, on tablet, and they're either going to pull that off or they're going to bomb badly.
Because it doesn't really seem like Win 8 is that different than Win 7, right? Like Gabe was saying, it probably is, like, it is an in-place upgrade. If corporations even go to it, it's an in-place upgrade, and it's got the nice UI for, you know, to try to, like, compete with people, you know, who like nice UIs or whatever. But it doesn't seem like there's a lot of core changes in Win 8, right?
I mean, let's face it. The enterprise users use mice and keyboards, right? They're not going to – I mean, the tablet world for Windows is completely unknown, right? And people who have Windows Phone 7 kind of like it, but it's very different.
Yeah.
And the average user – look, I mean, people get old with their GUIs, right?
I was visiting this weekend with Rick Dellinger. And so I stayed there for the weekend, and they had one of these HP Touch Smart like PCs literally in their kitchen. It's just like the commercial family, you know, three kids, the dogs, they sit around, they all have user accounts like every kid has, and they play with that while, you know, while they're cooking and watching TV. And it's got the touch interface on it. And after using this touch interface for, you know, about 5 minutes, and my arm was really, really tired. I'm thinking, like, if only I can just rest my arm yet still have a touch interface.
And control that pointer.
Yeah, and then Rick, like, slides the mouse to me.
we need countertops and tables made with Microsoft Surface displays.
Exactly.
Your former colleague, Harry Labana, has said many occasions that he believes that Windows 7... or if Windows 8 truly is a drop-in upgrade, but like this migration we're doing now from essentially the world is doing from XP to 7, that will be the last Windows migration that we as an industry do. Because the next big one that comes along that really changes things is going to be 5, 10 years, and we're not going to care about Windows anymore. Do you agree with that statement?
It's what I hear repeatedly from CIOs. That's what I hear. And moreover, there are other reasons that they say it. That is, every time the enterprise does this, it comes down an interesting licensing discussion with Microsoft, and those battles are fast and furious and so on. And very few people have the appetite to continue that. That what they want is a bit more balance in the power struggle, right?
Could Microsoft completely change this game by fundamentally overhauling the way they do licensing for enterprises?
They could, but are they able to do that? So, I mean, one of the... Microsoft.
So I guess the question is, could Gaddafi maintain power if he just suddenly decided, yes, I will become a full-on democracy, please elect me?
Actually, Microsoft's been hobbled by the consent decree very, very substantially.
What does that mean?
Remember, all the legal ramblings that went on in the, you know, at the end of the last century and beginning of this, right? So Microsoft has been massively constrained in its ability to change how it does business, owing to the consent decree, which was, you know, whether or not it was monopolistic, right? So license changes at Microsoft are incredibly difficult to get done. They always involve discussions with the Department of Justice. And, you know, it's been incredibly difficult for them to move forward. That said, I think sometimes they've made it incredibly hard themselves. Let's just go back to, say, VDI and the VDA Cal, right? That partially was part of their challenge. There was Department of Justice issues. You know, there are other reasons why Microsoft doesn't want to disrupt the average way that Windows gets to the user, which is on a new PC from an OEM. You know, they want it installed on hardware, and that's a rational thing to want from their perspective.
But on the enterprise side of things, I mean, it's that doesn't count, right? I mean, cause none of the enterprise licenses, if you know, enterprises don't buy PCs with the Windows installed, or if they do,
they can't.
But those licenses don't even count. Like, you still have to upgrade those to SA or.
Well, the enterprise license is an upgrade or a downgrade on OEM, so that you, right? And so the average enterprise use in the large enterprise, yes, they reimage the device. SME, they don't. That is, the device shows up with Windows, and then they just, you know, they just do an upgrade, in place upgrade from OEM to Enterprise Edition.
In our last 5 minutes or so, let's kind of shift gears again and talk about VMworld. Simon, are you going to VMworld?
I'm not, actually.
This is your first
time in 6 years.
Not. Yeah. So what are you looking for? You know, you know, obviously you'll be paying attention to VMworld. So what's most interesting to you about, you know, what you might hear at VMworld?
Well, I'm interested to see where VMware is going with Vue. I think the VMware was stretching a little too far in terms of its ambitions with Vue and all of its data center and cloud stuff. That is, in general, for a vendor of its size to be able to do both and do them both successfully is very challenging. Plus, they've got a bunch of other assets that somehow have to be paid for, right? All those other crazy things they bought. So, you know, to my mind, Vue it's a little bit like Apple TV. It's an interesting project for them. It's kind of what they do to add friction to Citrix, right? They hand out some free Vue CALs, you know, with ESX just to make it a pain for Citrix.
And to count those as Vue licenses in production probably, right?
That's right. So I'm interested to see what they do there and where they're going with it. To me, VMware's path on desktop is still very much a work in progress.
It's interesting. They have a couple ex-Citrix folks now. I know Phil Montgomery is there. Well, I guess that's it.
There's a bunch of
Kevin,
ex-Citrix.
Yeah, Kevin Goodman. I mean, yeah, lot
in the marketing world, there's a bunch.
Full, yeah. But I feel like these guys get to the desktop, right? But you think maybe it's one of those things where they might not even be able to do what they would want to do.
So look, I mean, my experience there is Zen Client versus whatever they were up to. But they had their own Type 1 Client Hypervisor in development. And Zen Client was extraordinarily difficult project. And that what I learned out of that is that open source has never done a good job on a client before. And most of that comes down to just graphics. So here's what I learned out of that. Intel documentation is sparse to non-existent. It's mostly in people's heads. What they generally do is write software, throw it over the wall to Microsoft or over the wall to Apple, and that's how you get great, you know, graphics and so on, all support for all the hardware, or it comes from NVIDIA, whatever. Getting those guys to actually work in an open source context with the Zen project was really hard, and it took 2 years to get it right, and a huge, huge effort. Same on the TPM and TXT stuff. So I just think it was just way too much for VMware to take on seriously, and that failed.
And it's interesting because VMware, I mean, all they care about is, you know, the attach rate of VMs in the data center.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
right.
It seems to me that
see Cloud Foundry, for example. Right.
What's Cloud Foundry?
Cloud Foundry is their cloud application server stack, which will run whatever Ruby through .NET, but it's all open source and free. In other words, it's just driving consumption of VMs.
Okay, right. So, and it's the same thing, I guess, with the desktop. Because to me, I guess I feel like their view of the desktop has always been more in the data center. And so I was thinking about that was probably their reason for canceling their hypervisor, because it's not a socket in the data center. So it doesn't fit into kind of their worldview of what they need to do as an organization.
I think it was just it was too big of a stretch for them. And we've hired a few people out of there, and that group's been pretty demoralized.
Let me ask you, we've got about 2 minutes left. So for, you know, you obviously read our website and chime in occasionally, so thank you for that. So people like me, people like that read our site, people who attend things like Briar Forum, you know, what should they kind of be paying attention to, thinking about? If you had, you know, 2 minutes with someone to say, here's what you got to be thinking about the next 6 months as you think about desktops and the industry, what do you want to leave people with?
So I think this really is hard for me to say, Brian, but you've been right all along.
Wow.
Very, very tough. No, on the VDI thing, I am firmly of the view that you are, you know, that you've got it. And I think that we need to challenge the perception that VDI is the weight of the future in terms of the desktop. I think we need to really think that one through again.
All right. Well, I guess, Gabe, what do you like? Anything that's sort of burning a hole in your brain you want to chat about, Gabe?
You know, I just want to say, you know, I think it's been really great having Simon here. Simon, I'm always fascinated when you've been speaking. I've been a CTP and stuff for a couple of years now. And, you know, every time that I've had seen you speak at CTP meetings, and I even participated with you on a panel one time. And so it's always great. I love hearing what you have to say and your insight. And I hope we can do this again.
Oh, thanks.
I like that you kind of act like a dick sometimes, which is exactly what I do, too. So that's all right. So our segment on why we like Simon is done. and So with that, so a couple of notes. You know, so Gabe and I will both be at VMworld next week. As well as about six or eight of our TechTarget colleagues. We have a website we created called searchvmworld2011.com, which was just created from our editorial group who wanted to put a website together where you could actually find content.
That's great, actually. Then I'll just have to sit at home and I can watch it.
Yeah, so search VMworld2011.com is going to be everything that we write across all groups from TechTarget. So we'll look for that there. We're going to have a couple live broadcasts both on Tuesday and Wednesday from the Expo Hall floor. We'll be broadcasting out of the TechTarget booth. So anyone who's there at VMworld, pop on by. We'll have the chat engine and everything up and running. So with that,
while we're talking about conferences too, so the Briform videos are actually going to be up hopefully today, maybe tomorrow at the latest, but they were every single Briform video will be up.
Oh, brilliant.
If you attended, you can you can watch them all probably starting tomorrow, I would say.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's wrap. Gabe, thank you for your time. Simon, thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
From San Francisco, this is Brian Madden. Thank you for listening to Brian and Gabe Live.